This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change. In particular, we acknowledge the Wangan and Jagalingu cultural custodians and their ongoing opposition to coal mining on their lands in central Queensland, and to the Gomeroi traditional custodians' continuing opposition to coal and gas on their land in New South Wales. It is vital at this late stage in history that we all learn to care for country. It will always be Aboriginal land, and now is our time to all stand up for and protect it.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene tu cueca de lucha cabalgando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero.
Show starts in Santa Marta, Colombia. Many speeches have been happening there on each day, and I've been listening and reading them, but just the best bits for you I found are, one was from the Environment Minister, Irene Vélez Torres. She said, people all over the globe are demanding to stop fossil fuels. We have seen the damage. This is the right time. The more we wait, the more difficult it will be to make the right decision for our children. We have to do it soon. We have to do it orderly. What we want here is for this coalition of willing countries to think collectively. Free from the lobby of the oil industry, this is the moment to put all our cards on the table. There's a special strand there for scientists, and top scientist Johan Rockström was there. He's the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. And he said, with another El Nino on the horizon and the prospect of overshooting the 1.5 centigrade limit, it has never been more important that leaders will demonstrate informed decisions on climate action. There was another scientific panel on the oceans perspective, and they identified the challenge to phasing out of offshore oil and gas extraction, which is at the moment growing. One of the most inspiring speeches was to a Colombian woman called Yuveles Morales. She won the Goldman Prize. It's considered to be the Nobel Prize for environmentalists. And Yuveles has campaigned against fracking along the Rio Magdalena. Her words, I'd like to read to you, which I have to write down from the Spanish translation at the bottom of the screen. But she said this. I really loved her. If you could watch YouTube Goldman Prize, you can watch it and put, if you don't speak Spanish, put the subtitles on. She's just a dazzling speaker. She said, today I begin by prioritizing life, the river, and our dreams, because every dream of peace is fished from the river of life. In my home in Puerto Wilches, The certainty of tomorrow is brought by a fisherman, by farmers who sow hope, and by those who have endured the horrors of war and still choose peace. I come from this land of radiant sun, vast valleys and rebellious river. I come from the riverbank. I am a daughter of the Magdalena River. Those of us born along its shores live with a deep passion that defines us. We defend with our spirit and care with our heart. For that reason, I fight against fracking in the most dangerous country in the world for community leaders and environmental activists. Being here today honors those who have suffered violence for defending their territory, water, and life itself. It honors people like myself who believe in the just transition away from fossil fuels. That's how I arrived at the Colombia Free of Fracking Alliance, where we reject development that looks to destroy nature, to dry up rivers and cut down trees. One that forces communities to give up their land for what lies beneath. One that does not recognize the human right to water and life when a multinational corporation arrives to exploit the earth's inner depths, flattening mountains and leaving a deep pit in what was once sacred land. For that reason, the world should say no to fracking. And there were tumultuous cheers at her speech. This kept being interrupted by very enthusiastic audience. So you see, great things are happening in Colombia. I'll be back in June with interviews from Santa Marta, but today we'll have a book review of Vigil by George Saunders and my conversation with Elizabeth Maddox. And then we have Scott from the Bob Brown Foundation at the March in March, talking about defending the forest. And Mark Carter from Flight Free Australia on how we can use this moment when jet fuel is at a premium to think of alternatives. Here's one of the alternatives.
Welcome aboard. Before we take off, we are going to give you an important safety briefing. So listen to the cabin crew as we provide you with information about flying that you may not have heard before.
Flying to London and back will increase your annual emissions by 50%.
We'll be frying the planet in the fastest way possible.
Please make sure you put all your preconceptions about flying out of sight, like your baggage. All sources of those preconceptions must be turned off. Disable the algorithms that greenwash flybys and frequent flyer points. What I am about to say will take your breath away. So put on the oxygen mask and take a few deep breaths. Global warming is about to hit the 1.5 degrees Paris limit. This flight will create three times more warming than you've been told. So, the best thing we can do right now is to locate our life jackets, because emissions need to reach near zero urgently, and because sustainable aviation fuels and offsets don't cut flight emissions.
In normal life, we don't wear a life jacket. But at 1.5 degrees of warming, life is no longer normal. In any emergency, it's abnormal behavior that gets us to safety. Net Zero 2050 is a climate crash flight path. So yes, by wearing the life jacket, you are sending the right message.
Why not stop flying until it's emissions free? It makes sense.
Why not stay grounded in reality? Explore the awesome just outside your front door.
You should now have some motivation to exit the plane. So take a moment to spot your nearest exit. Be aware that it may be behind you. If you're now slightly anxious, try counting the number of rows between your row and the exit. Now unclip your seatbelt and make your way to your nearest exit. Our aircraft is fitted with escape slides and life rafts, which the crew will now help you get to.
Flying is the most warming single thing you can do. It's time to evacuate.
Hey, are you still in your seat? Wake up and get out now. Those remaining should brace for impact.
I have Elizabeth Maddox with me to talk about a new novel called Vigil. She is an ardent climate campaigner and an inspired teacher, and she's here to help us see what this book has to offer. So welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, and I'd like you to start by telling us how this novel centers on a dying oil tycoon and why you see it as a contemporary morality play.
Well, good morning, Vivian. Thank you very much. It's a contemporary morality play because it is a very polar text, a very polar story, which sets us up between angelic forces who are trying to save the soul of the dying oil baron and demonic forces, which are those propelling the oil baron into self-justification of his being behind the plot to conceal climate change and its effects from the public. So this oil tycoon lying there on his deathbed is being set up as singularly responsible for the choice to conceal everything that's going on with climate change from the public. And in fact, we have two protagonists in the story. One is the undead angel, who is a very naive young woman, unable to relinquish her human life altogether and therefore leave this, which is a little bit like the bardo in which the story takes place, and join with everything that is, so become elevated, sort of like enlightenment, I guess. And we have this dying oil baron who is unable to repent for his sins.
Yeah, well, I forgot to say to the listeners, so, this book is by George Saunders, who wrote Lincoln in the Bardo. So that's why I asked Lizzie to read it, because she loved that book. I didn't like it, so I thought, oh, she might get more out of it than me. So this ghostly character, Jill, she visits the dying man, but what are her intentions with him?
Yes, well, I had hoped that her intentions might be to address climate change in some way, because they talk a lot about climate change that he has covered up from the public. But her intentions are actually to save his soul. So she tries very hard to comfort him and to persuade him that his actions were inevitable. And it seems that this belief in comfort and this belief in inevitability, as the book says, it starts with the most extraordinary originality as the angel plummets to earth. But it's actually a scene, a set piece straight out of Wim Wenders' film Wings of Desire, where the angel falls to earth, which is lovely. I love that film, and I love that Saunders is paying homage to these great works.
Yeah, and these angels hovering around, angels wanting to reform us and repent us, and by doing that, repenting the earth. And I was thinking, if you imagine the oil and gas industry as that dying subject, with the drones, just because the recent moments with the drones of the Persian Gulf buzzing about his head, you know, the whole industry is lying there, and these, you know, Straits of Hormuz is the crisis moment and the buzzing drones. But are there voices in the novel which show an alternative view of the earth, which shows that you can't go on plundering it and fighting over it and shedding blood over it? It's sacred. And I wondered if there are voices from the ocean and from the skies, you know, as we're heating them up. You know, is Saunders making us aware of the enormity of this?
In a way, he is. We meet one character who criticizes, who has the temerity to criticize our hero KJ, our anti-hero KJ Boone, when he's giving a speech. But he's very modest and sweet and unsupported by any system. And then we have a sort of an elite of snobs who turn the cold shoulder to the capitalist cronies who are running the fossil fuel industry, but don't do anything apart from turning up their noses. But there is, I think, probably the most eloquent defense of the earth comes from KJ Boone, our anti-hero oil baron himself. And I'd like to read that to you, if I may.
Okay, do.
Yes, I'd like to read you a section of a speech that KJ Boone makes to a challenger. Now, I said that this book was a little bit like a morality play where you have an angel and a devil fighting for the soul of a common man. And our angel is our little undead narrator, Jill Doll Blaine. Sounds a bit like Chill Blaine. Reminds us of Barbie, whom she talks about quite a lot. And KJ Boone, Kenneth J. Boone, who's named after a mentally ill man who killed his father, sounds a little bit like the parasite. And then you've got the Ken and Barbie duality, but you've also got the duality of Jill Dolblain trying to win KJ Boone's soul, and this other undead narrator who's a Frenchman who developed the internal combustion engine, and he's being addressed in this little speech. Did that frog have any idea just how much motor fuel it took for the US to have one normal year, just like we now had? 150 billion gallons. 150 billion. Try to work your head around that, Pierre, if you can. Get hold of a gas container of the type used to gas up a lawnmower. Get hold of a lot of them. By the time I'm done, you'll wish you were in the gas can business. Ha ha. Line them up side by side to get to 150 billion gallons. That line of cans is going to need to go around the world. Wait, not just once, not twice, 1,000 times. And somebody has to go out there and find the stuff, right? Get it out of the ground, process it, deliver it. Was that easy? It was not. Take it from someone who'd actually done it. Otherwise, what? Did the frog want to start rationing? Was that the notion? Rationing fuel? Who was going to run that deal? Some vast international bureaucracy? Feel good about that, Jacques? Think that's going to be an efficient process? Been to the UN lately? The post office? And guess who'd get hurt the most? If the hand-wringers get their way, brought the whole deal to a halt? The poor. That's who? Those who have the least. What's the tide that lifts all boat? Continual growth? Is continual growth a given? It is not. Any idiot knows that. So don't rush off half-cocked. That's all he was saying, all he'd ever said. Let's not leap off a cliff about it. What's the rush? Consider the timeline. Cogitate on the complexity of the overall system. Consider Lao Tzu. Govern a great nation as you would cook a small fish. Don't overdo it. Or next thing you know, some know-nothing from Washington's in your bedroom assessing how well you're putting on your socks. Let's keep researching, keep investigating. Even if the hysteria brigade's correct, 20 years isn't going to make a diddly bit of difference. Weren't these the same jackasses who'd predicted a coming ice age? Put that in your cheese-smelling pipe and smoke it, mon frère.
Yeah,
And I love
well,
the close, which is a sort of an allusion to Baudelaire's mon frère, mon semblable. So you, my brother, you're just like me. You're doing the same as me.
So I was going to say, I mean, I did notice that this George Saunders had worked in Sumatra in the 80s as an engineer in the oil industry. They must have cut down an awful lot of forest to, start up the oil industry there. But he would know their mindset. And I think that's very instructive for us. If we're doing climate action, we need to know other people think. I've always fantasized about having one of these big oil executives or coal barons on the radio show, but they keep an extremely low profile, you'll notice. They're never really in the media, and they wouldn't come on this show. So I think he's trying to give us an insight into how they think. But like, he's not just a villain, is he? Is he? It sounds like a more nuanced portrait. What did you learn about how big capital thinks, really?
Well, he is represented as being a loving father, as being a loving husband. His wife and daughter adore him, but they too use language to cover up the fact that they know he knew what he was doing wrong. And I think Saunders is trying to show us how we all normalize what's going on. When he goes to the wedding, when the angel pops into the mind of all the wedding guests generally know about climate change and they are continuing business as usual. So KJ Boone is, while we get this sense that he's a demon because he says it is finished and he invokes Jesus like that, we also get the sense that he's another ordinary person who's just doing the same as another 100 people that he names who are also perpetrating the lie that climate change doesn't hurt the earth
Well, the people
or
who
isn't happening.
oppose climate change or who are active, like many we would know, does Saunders not know them or does he consider them as sort of humbugs? Because I'm thinking of other people who've been in the oil industry and who've had a big change of heart, like Kevin Anderson. Many listeners will remember him on the radio show, and Ian Donlop, You know, they've grown old protesting about this. They were in, Ian Dunlop was head of Shell at one stage, and Kevin Anderson was, doing those big North Sea oil platforms, all the engineering. He knows it from inside, like obviously Saunders probably does. But both of them saw that fossil fuels were driving the world to collapse, and they turned, they changed, and they became ardent activists and outspoken. Like Kevin Anderson's at every, he's on all these podcasts and YouTubes, and he's giving his expertise. And he's not naive at all about how enormous the change is, how enormously hard it is to do this big economic change. But I wondered, is this book a political book? Do we learn anything from it that's helpful to us?
Yes, I wondered that. I think that Saunders is pointing out just how easy it is to trick everybody and lie to everybody. And he is not really revealing a pathway to address it, except, there's no of that, none of that optimism of Dr. Seuss. When in the Lorax, there's this unless moment at the end. There's no unless moment in this book, unless it's the reader who's holding the book, who's feeling, well, this isn't okay. I've got to do something about this. So there's not much of a movement visible. And I did wonder also about the naivety of the protagonist. I wondered, is she meant to be an average American citizen? So she's a really problematic person for me. Apart from having that dreadful name, Jill Blaine, she's a colourless character. She wears insipid colours and she knows nothing about climate change, despite having hovered around the Earth from her death in 86, 1986 till the present. She hasn't picked up a thing. And I think I have this nasty feeling that she is Saunders' ideal reader or his planned reader, somebody really naive who has to be dragged through the hard facts of the consequences of climate change in order to understand that it needs to be consciously addressed. So, but that's only part of it. The other half of that dual narrative that happens simultaneously is that the people at the wedding know something's off and are not investigating. So it's cautionary. If it's political, it's cautionary.
Well, listeners will know that I've been doing program after program since February, since Venezuela was attacked. I've been doing programs about the Santa Marta conference, which is on this week in Colombia. And honestly, this book would not go well down there, I don't think, because those people have see the nuance, see the complexity. They've published reports just on phasing out fossil fuels, the financial side, the engineering side, all the workers, the trade union side, the indigenous people, they've got all those voices in there. And I wonder if Saunders should go down to that conference. I think he'd see something that he couldn't be cynical about, because there's some enormously wonderful thing happening there. And that's why I didn't want to read the book, and I asked you to read it. I'm glad you've enjoyed it and you've got a lot out of it. Is there one last thing you'd like to say to readers, or listeners, that they should perhaps read the book? Because I don't feel like reading it, but I think you've got a lot out of it.
No, I would encourage you to read it. It pokes fun at what Saunders holds dear, and in a way, he's poking fun at himself and at all of us by asking us to ponder: is our conduct inevitable? Do we have a choice in the matter? Are we predestined to succumb to what's going on, or have we got some agency? And I think it's quite an entertaining ride, and you'll enjoy the playful allusions and just consider the extent to which we can really make a difference.
Could I just ask you one sort of personal question? Because you're a teacher and some of your students have been these very active kids doing the Fridays for Future and those huge rallies we had in Sydney. I suppose in Melbourne they had the same big movement a few years back. You've been, with them and urging them on and inspiring them and learning from them, I would think, as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What are your thoughts now about the 2026 generation of young people who are coming through the school? Is it darker, harder?
Oh my goodness, I'm feeling that maybe they need to be talked to the way Jill Dolblain is being talked to in this book. Maybe they need the kind of gentle leading to understand what's going on. I mean, there are some who are razor sharp in their knowledge and insight and understanding, but many just need to be guided and led and shown that the authorities actually are not in control of what's going on, that we can't just trust our leaders.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a sad note to end on, but we've been speaking to Elizabeth Maddox, who's written a beautiful book review of Vigil by George Saunders. And her life has also demonstrated that taking climate action, keeping hope alive, encouraging people, giving courage is very worthwhile. So thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you, Vivian. Thanks for all the wonderful work you do.
My name's Darrell Best. I worked all my working career in coal mines. I am now passionate about a transition to renewables and about saving our planet. And you are listening to the Climate Action Radio Show on Community Radio. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high-quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Now let's go to the March in March. It's an annual event, Australia-wide, to raise public awareness of the extractivism that goes on in our forests. And forest action is climate action. People dressed as wombats and kookaburras and children dancing made it a colourful scene. Here is Scott from the Bob Brown Foundation.
Ten years ago, a group of us walked into a forest in the Franklin River area in the north of Turkina. And the six of us walked 8 kilometres behind a locked gate, ready to stop the bulldozers that were due to arrive. We sat down and we talked about what would happen in the morning when the police turned up and dragged us away. Well, over the next 6 months, hundreds of people turned up and joined us. And after 2 years of holding that forest, the bulldozers didn't turn up. They took it off the schedule. People taking a stand on the ground, standing in the way, saying, "This will not happen." That's what saves forests. That's what we need to be doing, folks. Over the last 10 years in Turkina, they have labelled 2,500 hectares of forest for logging. They've lobbed it up into forest coops, they passed the forest practices plans, they've authorised the logging of these areas, and they were set to turn up. But so did you. You guys turned up. And over the last 10 years, we've had 5,000 people join us on those blockade front lines in Tasmania, in the Tarkine Forest. And out of that 2,500 hectares they were due to log, they have got just 50. Just 50, because people like yourself stood in front of those bulldozers and said, "Not on my watch." When you were kids, your parents told you you had to behave yourself. Well, it turns out you don't. I'm going to tell you today, do not behave yourself. If they are coming to destroy our forest, if they are coming to push our wildlife to extinction, if they are come to destroy the things we care about, do not behave yourself. Stand up. Get out to those blockades here in New South Wales. Join us on the front lines down in Tasmania in the Tarkine. Be there. Make a difference. Stand up and make sure your voice can't be ignored. You guys have got an election coming up next year, I hear. Well, you know, I can give you a bit of advice here. The difference between Labor and Liberal on our forests is that the Liberals will smash our forests while they smile, while Labor will smash our forest while they wring their hands and tell you how sorry they are. The effect on the forest is the same. If you want change on forest, do not vote for Labor, do not vote for Liberal. For God's sake, don't vote for One Nation. But get out there and back in candidates who promise who will deliver real action for climate change, real action for our forest, protection of our species, and take to the front lines and stand with you to achieve that. If they won't promise that, do not vote for them. That Parliament's not a fun place to be. I occasionally have to go up and knock on doors, and it's the Marines and the Greens and some of the crossbenchers that are all happy to talk to us, but we can't even get a meeting with Labor because they are so ashamed of what they do. They don't want to have to look you in the eye and make their apologies. Well, don't accept it. Let's replace them. Let's see a Parliament full of people who will stand up for our forest, who want to protect our native species, who want to see this climate a safe and livable space. And look, and most of all, remember that democracy doesn't end at the ballot box. Democracy ends when you turn up at events like this, when you join those protests on the front lines, when you are more afraid of losing our precious native species and our forests than you could ever be of the draconian and archaic anti-protest laws we are seeing brought in all around this country. And what I can tell you is the more draconian those laws have become, the more people have stood up and joined us. We are a contrary species, folks. We don't like being told not to stand up. We will keep standing up. We, certainly at the Bob Brown Foundation, are going to be at that front line, making sure that we're as loud as we can possibly be, we're as disruptive as we can possibly be, and we will not back down until our native forest is protected. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here today. Thank you for being such a staunch group. Get out there and defend your forest. Join the frontline campaigns. Join those election campaigns. Make a difference. Let's see native forest logging end for once and for all.
When you compare an old growth forest compared to a forest which is regrowing after a disturbance like logging, they're actually quite different ecosystems. Generally, like older, wetter forests slow down the path of fire, and this is actually quite a well-known phenomenon. Historically, these big, large fires have been quite rare, but what we've seen in the last 20 years is they're becoming quite a lot more common. So we've had 3 in the last 20 years. This is definitely because of climate change, which is making our ecosystems a lot drier and the fire weather more intense.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
This is Stephen Pigram from up Broomway, Yarra country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time. Where I belong.
The next story, listeners, is on aviation. Are you braced for the impact of news you might not want to hear? So with the Middle East oil crisis causing jet fuel prices to double and double again, and airlines to ground planes, I'm wondering, will the public mind turn to alternative fuels or alternatives to flying altogether? One of my friends told me about an ABC News article about replacing jet fuel with homegrown canola. It quotes CSIRO Max Temminghoff, who says, quote, by 2050, the demand for aviation fuel will be around 14 billion litres. It's 10 billion at the moment, I think. Our supply of feedstock, including canola, could potentially be 90% of that. So I wondered how much food production would have to be sacrificed to produce all that feedstock. But then I thought I'd go to someone who has another alternative. But let's get the expert, which is Mark Carter. He's done a lot of thinking about that. And his organisation is called Flight Free Australia. He's motivated, I know, by a deep awareness of the need for climate action. But he's also getting through to people in with humour. And that funny ad you heard before, that was one of his. Brilliant work. So welcome, Mark. Let's start with let's start with sustainable aviation fuels, SAF. Most people like to trust that the cost of sustainable aviation fuels will come down and that companies like Qantas will reach net zero emissions. They just believe that because that's what the companies are telling them. And would you say, is there any reason why we can't actually grow enough canola and refine it here to substitute for the 11 billion litres of jet fuel that we're now importing?
Thanks, Vivian. Sustainable aviation fuels is the it's being spruiked by the aviation industry and the government as the sort of salvation for aviation in terms of its response to global warming. There's a range of issues with sustainable aviation fuel that sort of really make it an ineffective response. The fuel is super expensive. Airlines around the world are pulling back on their commitments to the percentage of their total fuel that they'll use from SAF. In years to come, they're pulling back on those commitments. It sort of sounds ridiculous. They're even talking about using waste oil, cooking oil, reusing that as a fuel for under the label sustainable aviation fuels. And that, you know, begs the question, how many million litres of used cooking oil are there available every day for a global fleet? So it's very expensive. It won't be deployed across the global fleet until 2040. The industry admits that. Qantas' commitment at the moment is 0.2% of its fuel is coming from SAF, and they're proposing 10% of it coming by 2030. On current climate estimates, we'll have hit 2 degrees warming by 2040. So SAF as a way to prevent 2 degrees of warming is kind of blown out of the water. By the time it's deployable, we will have already, most likely, according to the current science, have hit 2 degrees. The current science that I'm reading, to prevent 2 degrees of warming, we need to cool the planet as well as stop adding new emissions. And to cool the planet means drawing down carbon, the 426 parts per million, lowering that to 350 to cool the planet. And the trick with SAF that your listeners may have heard from the industry and from government is that it reduces aviation emissions. It doesn't. Burning SAF creates the same amount of aviation emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, as conventional jet fuel. The trick that they use, it's a paper on it, accounting trick. The amount of carbon that's drawn down in growing the feedstock, in growing the biofuels, in growing the fuel that creates that oil that ends up as waste cooking oil, that the carbon that's drawn down in growing that feedstock is subtracted from the carbon that's emitted in flight, and they say, therefore, it's less emissions. But thing is that reusing the carbon that's drawn down in creating the feedstock is undermining the whole effort to cool the planet that we need to do to hold back 2 degrees of warming. In practical sort of economic terms, in, you know, conventional business as usual terms, it's a really tricky ask because of its cost and its supply chains. But in the climate sense, it doesn't effectively reduce emissions and it won't stop us getting to 2 degrees.
No, and I also just think that the land should be used for food, you know, the agricultural land. And just to think of the amount of the world's good agricultural land and the rainfall that you normally expect should be just devoted to canola, boggles the mind. But look, I better get on because another thing that you mentioned, you've just written an article called Race for Impact, Qantas's Climate Crash Flight Path, which is very informative. But you mentioned something there called future soothing. And I'm really interested in why people have lost interest in climate action, why they just don't believe that my flight will count at all, you know, and it's about this future soothing. Can you explain how, you know, you've looked at some of the ads and the way the industry approaches people and even the media in general? What's this future soothing?
It's based on the idea, our kind of preference these days for technological solutions to the problems that we're facing, because so many technological developments have made life better in, you know, in various ways over the years.
Well, Al Gore used that word, the inconvenient truth. And I think that says a lot, doesn't it? It still works today. It's inconvenient to know this. Flying, since COVID, you know, flying has taken off again with a vengeance. Let's get back to government. How are aviation emissions regulated by government?
The emissions from their international flights aren't managed or regulated by the Australian government. They're regulated under the International Civil Aviation Organisation, a sort of a subsidiary UN organisation. But their regulation there is pretty light-handed. Emissions from international aviation can continue at the level they reached in 2019 before COVID forever under the regulations. But emissions above the 2019 levels are to be reduced on a voluntary basis by 2027, I think. The way they're going to do that, and the industry, there's articles in the industry press about this, they're buying carbon credits, carbon offsets.
That sounds to me like they're not regulating at all. They're hardly regulating at all. It's not serious. And meanwhile, they're sort of subsidising more research into these SAF fuels. I find this very discouraging, because we're being treated with this soothing to the idea that someone will turn up with a much better solution. It'll finally be guilt-free to fly. But really, they're not seriously regulating, and really, they're not using the fuels that would make it better, and it won't make it better. So altogether, yeah. We come back to why you are here, because you've got an organisation called Flight Free. So instead of alternative fuels, we may need to do some alternative travel.
That's right. We came to that realisation a few years ago, and others have as well, that really aviation emissions are hard to abate. That's the global consensus. But they're impossible to abate other than reducing the number of flights. We've talked about sustainable aviation fuels as a bit of a kind of a red herring, a bit of greenwashing by the industry of the public to think that there are solutions where you can fly and be emissions free. But unfortunately, we can't. And the good thing about this is that it puts thinking about having to consider not flying rather than, you know, offsetting your emissions or hoping that SAF will come along, is that it puts us in the frame of mind that we really need to be in the climate emergency as a whole, where our normal regime of doing things is no longer working, and we need to do what's abnormal. As yeah. I said elsewhere, as in any other emergency, in a bushfire, we do things that we wouldn't otherwise do in order to get to safety. And so this not flying is one of those abnormal things.
Well, one of the people you quote in your report is Professor Kevin Anderson. The report is called Brace for Impact. Well, I've always liked Kevin Anderson, since we've been looking at climate change, being aware of it. He seems to turn up on all the conferences and webinars, and I especially like him because he had a sort of a huge change of mind. He was in the oil industry out on those North Sea oil rigs, and then he realised about climate impact of the oil, and he's now one of the foremost scientists speaking about 3 degrees of warming or 4 degrees of warming, which people might think, oh, 3 or 4, they don't get it. A few years ago, we used to hear about a lot about what that would mean. And he keeps saying it. He says it would be civilizational collapse, ecological collapse, collapse of everything. We're seeing, you know, Middle East crisis now, but it seems to be contained. Most people are able to put it out of their mind. But there are signs of collapse of a lot of systems. And Kevin Anderson's the one who never stops talking about it. And he doesn't fly. I appreciate the fact that he always says he goes from an English university to a Swedish university by train. That's a long trip. But he does it because he just doesn't fly. And he says, look, we can't risk this 3 degrees of warming. And I can remember a few years ago, we all knew that we can't risk it. But it seems to me the knowledge of that has really gone, faded, lulled. We've been soothed out of thinking about it all the time. It's not in the media. Climate is hardly in the media. And I want to know from you, I've got a lot of friends who are grandparents. You know, they show me photos of their children, and their retirement is spent on overseas travel, flying off to this place and that place, and then they show me the photos of the trips overseas. I don't get it. Those grandchildren will be alive at the end of this century, which Kevin Anderson says could be 3 degrees warmer.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's because the responses that are being in the public space to our climate situation are ineffective. So people, the whole range of responses are not commensurate with the level of the problem. So people get disheartened when a solution that's put up, they realise it's not going to be effective. The climate emergency response, which is not in the public conversation, that the things are abnormal, that we are in an emergency and therefore our responses have got to be different.
And do you think there was a bit of a detour back there when people started talking about system change, not climate change, and individual emissions don't matter, it doesn't matter, you're individual, you must work on government, but governments just follow the people and they'll only go as far as they're pushed, it seems to me. And we don't push them very hard, so they now, Anthony Albanese has been flying all around the place getting more aviation fuel, more fuel, more fuel. Not one media person seems to ask him, are you putting more effort into accelerating the renewable energy transport, electrifying our transport fleet, for example? It just doesn't come up anymore because people don't force it. And they don't force it because they're thinking, oh, it's system change, not climate, not individual. You know, my individual footprint doesn't matter.
In terms of system change, individual change, as people will surely acknowledge, it's both. They both kind of work on each other. You can be through individual behaviour change, you can be sort of like a role model which affects others that then builds a critical mass that influences kind of politics. The government can, there are instruments the government can use to cut aviation emissions. The Minister of Aviation sets airport flight capacities for all the airports around Australia, that except for Sydney Airport, separately regulated. And it's within her powers to redefine that airport flight capacity as a flight emissions capacity, ideally to be reduced each year. So there are instruments available to the government to tightly regulate the aviation emissions. One regulatory thing, the government could fast track high speed rail. They're just dithering around. They took ages even to appoint a head of the authority last year. And they're now talking about just sort of the Sydney-Newcastle leg. There's argument that for far less money, the existing route, for instance, from Melbourne to Sydney, could be straightened at critical parts of that trip and take... It wouldn't be as fast as the 3 hours speculated for high-speed rail to Sydney, but it would be way more convenient and way faster.
Just talk a bit about the alternative, yourself and people you know, what it does for your mind not flying. You know, you're thinking about the world or about other people. Does it change your attitude?
But as far as not flying goes, flying freeing us from the restrictions of sort of space and time and geography and stuff is, it gets us somewhere exotic really quickly. But on the other hand, it distances us from our visceral physical reality, which is, you know, the ground beneath our feet and the things that are growing in our neighbourhood, that distancing of really our life support systems, the critical things that give us life and keep us alive, that distancing from those things, I'd argue, flying kind of promotes, only makes the challenge of preventing 2 degrees even harder. We're not as located in the real world. We're living in this delusional world of where we can, you know, fly wherever we want to.
Yes, I've found that. But also, as you say, we're of a generation that has already done a lot of travelling and people resent it. But I'm thinking for the babies who are born now, facing the end of the century, someone who's born now, 2026, by the end of the century, they'll be old people too. And they will be facing, I don't think any of us can imagine. Kevin Anderson says it's unimaginable. The first interview I did was with
Clive Hamilton?
Yes, I did an interview with Clive Hamilton, the very first interview I did with 3CR. And he had just been to a conference in London on 3 degrees of warming. And I felt like he'd been to the centre of Chernobyl. You know, he'd seen something horrific, horrific. And he came back, he couldn't stop talking about how horrific it would be if we continued this path. And that was at least 12 years ago. And I felt we were more aware of the horrific possibilities of what we're cumulatively doing, collectively doing, then than now. It's just kept out of our mind. And as you say, it's an illusory world of privileged people flying off. Not everyone in the world can fly, but wealthy people can just do what they like. And it seems to me you have to have an awareness of yourself as a collective society and not just individuals. So I only had to hear that lesson once. I don't think I've had to have any reinforcement of it, but it seems to me the media certainly have lost track of it. And that's why I was interested to talk to you. And you put out these funny ads to get through to people. I don't know if that people get it. They get the message that you are making a humorous, getting through humor to show that we are really in danger. That's the message, isn't it? We are really in danger.
Yes. And that's a super challenging problem to confront, because we have been told that everything just keeps kind of improving. That was kind of the neoliberal promise. But I think people are now realising, you know, terrible genocide in Gaza and the war on Iran, etc., and its impact on oil supplies, fuel supplies, that what we were promised is looking pretty shaky. And I mean, if you read a bit about it, there's a lot of very qualified experts and commentators are saying it's going to be very difficult to return to any old normal fuel supplies. And certainly, as I said before, on the climate front, the world is continuing to warm, and it's a massive challenge to stop the emissions and cool the planet so that we can get to a different future where it's the climate is safe.
Yes. All right, look, we better end there. Most of the programs I've been doing lately about the Santa Marta Conference, which is the first international.
Yeah, I saw that.
You've heard about it. The media doesn't seem to have heard about it yet, but I think that is a terrific thing, and I'll be very interested to hear what they say about transport emissions in general.
Aviation is often just sort of left out.
People say to me, oh, it's only like 2% or 5% of global emissions, or 15%, you know, some small number. But even that is huge. And it's the thing I think about aviation is that, from all that I've read, that it's increasing, that's increasing.
Yeah, growing 4% a year. And yeah, it's around 2% of CO2 emissions. But given the non-CO2 emissions create twice as much warming on a given flight as the CO2 emissions, its emissions are 5%, which people will say is still quite small. But when you consider that, without being too harsh on it, it's them and a small number of other people on the planet, of the 8 billion of us who are flying, that are doing it. It's okay, it's 5%, which is small, but it's a tiny percent, a really privileged and percent of the global population who are creating that 5%.
Yeah,
like it's not like everybody's contributing equally to create 5%. It's this small over-consuming minority.
And yeah. It's at our discretion when, as you said, we not only have to go beyond zero emissions, we have to go to drawdown. So every bit of emission, if everything emission is extra, that we have to draw down. And we're not into the drawdown phase at all, are we?
No.
Look, I'll have to leave it there. It's been good to talk to you, Mark. And listeners, if you want to check out Mark's report, it's on Flight Free Australia, a report called Brace for Impact. And Climate Code Red also has an article about it if you want to look them up. So Flight Free Australia. Thanks very much, Mark. It's been lovely to talk to you. And I love your brilliant satirical ads. That gets through to more people than a report, I think. Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye.
From New York to Rio and old London town, and the further, the wider, the more that I roam, the hotter Australia will burn.
Always
traveling.
I love to be
I
free.
I love to be free.
And so I just
and
won't
so
accept
I just
the reality.
Won't accept reality.
That
the flying's
the most
warming
single thing
you can do. I will help Australia.
We'll help Australia.
As long as you travel way above the ground on fossil fuels to which I am bound,
I will help Australia.
You've been listening to the Climate Action Show. My thanks today go especially to Natalia from the Fossil Free Treaty Initiative. She's in Rio at the moment. I think maybe she's now in Santa Marta, but she's been helping me with information and links because it's very hard to get a grip on what's happening in Santa Marta. And certainly the mainstream media have not been covering it, I don't think. If you hear Santa Marta, anything in depth on our radio or TV or in the papers, please ring up 3CR and leave a message for me, because I can't see any really deep reference to it. But it's the most exciting thing. So thank you to Natalia, who's made it easy for me. Thank you to Elizabeth Maddox, who read Vigil for us and discussed it. She's a great teacher. And, you know, she's one of the people who helps the students clarify their ideas. And a lot of the energy in climate action comes from very young people who start off in school teasing out their ideas and reading poems and books that get them started. And thank you to Scott from the Bob Brown Foundation. He revved up the crowd there at the March in March. And thank you to Mark Carter from Flight Free Australia for his most recent report. And while you're looking at his website, have a look at the little videos there, very funny, satirical videos making you think twice about flying. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid.
The
Don't
treasurer.
Be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.
Anda, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero. Canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene tu cueca de luz. que acabalgando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero.